Isaiah chapter 15. Before we continue with Isaiah chapter 15, we have a few verses left at the end of chapter 14, which was a long study, but which I'm going to set off distinct from chapter 14. It's a change of subject, and so it's almost, it doesn't really go with the subject matter of the previous chapter. At least I don't really see a distinct connection there. It seems like a separate prophecy to me. Verse 28 of chapter 14, in the year that King Ahaz died, was this burden. Remember, the previous chapter was the burden of Babylon, or that started in chapter 13, actually. So this feels like a separate burden to me. We're in the midst of a section that is filled with the burdens, which are prophetic doom. It's what they have to carry, the punishment that they are due. So this burden came in the year that King Ahaz died. Verse 29, rejoice not thou, whole Palestina, because the rod of him that smote thee is broken. For out of the serpent's root shall come forth a cockatrice, and his fruit shall be a fiery flying serpent. So what's that mean? Well, the king Ahaz died, and he's looking to the Philistines, because that's what this Palestina is, that's a later translation, but in the Hebrew original, it would have been the land of the Philistines. The Philistines should not rejoice because the rod of him that smote them is broken, meaning the rod of the house of David, because David was the one who subdued the Philistines, and Ahaz is the successor. Boy, are you saying the house of David is a serpent and the cockatrice? No, that's what the Philistines thought of him as. That serpent David. That nest of vipers. The house of David, Ahaz. So out of the root shall come forth a cockatrice, a more deadly snake. And his fruit shall be a fiery flying serpent. Or a covering serpent. Flying is perhaps not the right term. It may be a serpent with a hood. Though I don't know if any hooded serpents would have been native to that area. But they may have been known, being carried from the east, perhaps. A hooded serpent. Remember, the word for wings is often used for extremities, like the wings of an army. Like when it talks about the four horns of the altar, or the horns that were emanating from the hand of the vision of God that Habakkuk observed. You know, he had horns coming out of his hands. Horns there means an emanation, a projection. And I believe there was some sort of, it says, and there was the hiding of his power. There was a projection, a visible projection of power emanating from the hand of God. That's from the vision of Habakkuk. And so also, flying or winged or covering can indicate some sort of extremity or a hood, perhaps. That's just speculation. It's not important, because the gist of what he's saying is quite clear. You think your enemy's been taken care of. He's dead. He's out of the way. But what's coming out of him is going to be even worse. When a king dies, a lot of times they think, well, maybe his son will not be as strong. It'll be an opportunity. But the Philistines never really rise again as a power. They've become a completely second-rate power. They don't really enter into history much after David subdues them. Verse 30, and the firstborn of the poor shall feed, and the needy shall lie down in safety. And I will kill thy root with famine, and he shall slay thy remnant. The firstborn of the poor is a figure of speech indicating the poorest of the poor. It's an idiom. These idealized images of society under the house of David, of course, ultimately is fulfilled in the person and ministry of Christ. Who of the seed of David, of the house of David? And he was the one who looked to the poor and who preached what the prophets proclaimed would be the concern of the king, which is the poor and the needy, the destitute. His compassion was towards those who had nothing. I think in our modern Christianity, we are so focused on the successful. When people are successful in ministry, we pour even more money into their ministry because look how successful it is. Look how much the gospel is being preached. When, you know, most Americans already believe in the gospel. We need people to live the gospel. I mean, there are places in the world where the name is, of Jesus has not been preached. It might be more effectively preached in all places if lifting the state of the poor was more what people were concerned about. Yeah, I know they say, give a man a fish, he'll eat for a day, teach him to fish, and he'll, you know, eat for the rest of his life. Well, then teach him to fish. Whatever. Whatever you see is the most helpful thing you can do. We certainly, I think, in our country do a lot for the poor. I don't think there's a lot more that needs to be done in our country. But I think it's interesting as Christians how concerned many people who identify, who are self-identified as Christians, how concerned they are with, the people should not be helped. And they are also very apt to shame people who receive assistance, which I find to be a very odd attitude. The needy shall lie down in safety. I mean, you know, how dangerous is it to be a homeless person? Who cares when they show up dead? Ah, who's this who's been murdered? Oh, it's a homeless guy. Well, nobody cared about him. No, apparently not. I will kill thy root with famine, and he shall slay thy remnant. You know, the scripture has a very common thread that the wicked societies are brought down and destroyed. You know, countries get so lifted up in their pride and in all that they accomplish and all they do and all their wealth and all their, you know, the things they make their boast in. And people would say, well, you know, we've strayed away from God in our country now. I was like, well, you know what? We may have to some degree. But I tell you what, there is no greater affront to God and to honoring God than that we should neglect the poor and needy. Now, if America is being spared from calamity for all the abominations committed, it might be because while we may be very sinful and honor not God, though most Americans are very God-fearing people, in my opinion, at least to some extent. I mean, at least they honor him with their lips. I'll tell you what, when you see God pronouncing judgment against nations, a lot of times it's like, you know, they neglected the poor, they were suffering and crying in the streets. The streets are filled with violence. The way in which we mistreat and neglect our fellow men, God is certainly concerned with that. More, perhaps, than many other failings that people may have. People look at Sodom and Gomorrah and they think homosexuality. And certainly homosexuality is a sin. The Apostle Paul makes that clear. The law makes that clear. It's the acts are sinful abominations. But don't think that Sodom and Gomorrah was just, oh, they just, all the only problem there was just they were allowing that to go on. For one, they wanted to rape a couple individuals. Yeah, it was homosexual rape. But, you know, according to the prophets, it was not merely this. It says, these were the sins of Sodom: pride, fullness of bread, abundance of idleness. Yes, and every abomination was in her, including those carnal abominations that everyone's familiar with. But what leads to that, the decadence of the society, is what causes the moral degradation. You know, the moral degradation doesn't really make the society decadent. The decadence comes first, then comes the moral degradation. So in our country, the homosexual issue is really just a symptom. You know, and you don't really cure sickness by dealing with the symptoms. It's a stopgap to some degree. You know, you can, you know, you have a cold, so you take a antihistamine. You've got a fever, so you take something to, an anti-inflammatory to reduce the fever. But that doesn't cure you. All it does is make you seem less sick. But when we're talking about moral problems in a society, it is not enough to just seem less sick. We won't have these abominations in our streets. Oh, yes, we will. As long as this country and all the world, as long as they are, you know, as long as they are turning aside the needy from judgment and neglecting the poor and the fatherless and the widows. And you know, as long as all that stuff goes on, the abominations are going to come to the surface because they are merely a symptom of a greater decadence, of a more abominable decadence. Yeah, I know it's an abomination for a man to be with another man, but it's a greater abomination for a man to watch another man suffer when it's in his power to relieve the suffering. And that's just a fact. Wicked societies have cycles that come to an end. Civilizations rise and fall. The Philistines fell. Verse 31, howl, O gate, cry, O city, thou whole Palestina. Again, Philistia, the land of the Philistines, art dissolved. For there shall come from the north a smoke, and none shall be alone in his appointed times. You know, the smoke from the north is doubtless a signal of, comes to me as the invading armies that would destroy that nation and carry them away finally into captivity, where they became absorbed. There are no Philistines. Historically, the Philistines ceased to be a people. They ceased to be a distinct people and a distinct civilization. You know, like the Hittites. For a long time, the Bible mentions these Hittites, and scholars used to scoff and say the Bible just has these imaginary people, the Hittites. They don't exist. But of course, eventually they did discover the Hittites, and they do exist. It was just they had not discovered their cities yet, and their civilization was as yet unknown. The only record there was the record of the scripture, and they didn't want to trust that record. When it says none shall be alone in his appointed times, what that means is none shall be left alone, like that idiom, that figure of speech. Of to be left alone means not so much you're going to have someone to go through it with you. You'll have, you know, misery loves company. That's not what it's talking about. What it's talking about, you will not be spared. You will not be left untouched. You will not be left alone. We have the same idiom today. You know, leave me alone, meaning the enemy will not let you alone. Verse 32, what shall one then answer the messenger of the nation? That the Lord hath founded Zion, and the poor of his people shall trust in it. You know, what is the message that comes out of this? You know, that the Lord has founded Zion. Zion, Israel, is going to be preserved by God. You know, even though they eventually were cast out of their land by the Romans, they still maintained themselves as a distinct people, a distinct culture even. And they eventually returned. And so the Lord has founded that. And the poor of his people shall trust in it. Has it been false? You could say, well, they suffered the Holocaust. They suffered all this persecution, but they still carry on, do they not? They were not extinguished by it. Where are the Philistines? And no, don't tell me about the Palestinians. The Palestinians are Arabs that eventually came into that territory after the Jews were expelled. The old Philistines are long gone. Yeah, I don't know what claims they make about ancestry and stuff, but the Philistines, they were a separate culture along the coast. They had come in ships originally as colonists and then colonized that part, and they came into conflict with the Israelites eventually. But the Lord has founded Zion, not the cities of the Philistines, and the Philistines and their culture were destroyed. But the culture which the Lord founded, which is represented by Mount Zion. Zion is sort of like, you know, I've never been quite clear about all the mountains. Zion, Moriah, the different mountains of Jerusalem. But, you know, they're all symbolically kind of referring to the same idea of the mountain where God establishes covenant. Originally with Abraham, but also with his descendants, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and also the 12 tribes, confirmed through Moses. And all that. And as Paul the Apostle said, he has not cast off his people. There is still a role in God's plan for the people who he made his covenant with. That does not mean that salvation is possible outside of the grace of Jesus Christ. By no means. But God is still going to deal with them. I don't know the exact count. I'm going to say millions, all right, of Jews who believe in Jesus. I don't know. There's probably quite a lot of them at this point. There's a lot of reasons for them to believe in him. Rabbinism, the Orthodox Judaism, And it's not really a very good religion. I'm sorry. I think it's a very self-serving, arrogant kind of belief system from what I've read of it. And I'm not going to get into a big thing against rabbinism and all that. I'm just saying that to say that just because a lot of Jews don't believe, well, a lot of Gentiles don't believe. A lot of God's people are also Jesus's people as well. I know that, you know, by and large, people look at it, all the Jews who don't believe. Well, because they're maintaining their separateness from Christ, you notice them. It's a lot easier to overlook all the Jews throughout history who have been Christians, not just in the first century, but even throughout history. A lot of Jews have converted to Christianity, yeah, some by force, but many not. And they're not always trumpeted because they don't always have much of a place among their people anymore. You know, becoming a Christian for most of history has meant you kind of are out among the Jews. I think in modern times, though, a lot of that is kind of coming to an end because of the liberalization of Judaism. Sort of makes it harder when you have so many Christian friends and you live in Christian countries. I would think it gets hard to maintain sort of like this really backwards prejudice against a Christian in your family, a Jew who becomes a Christian. I mean, you disallow them as part of the family because, you know, they've followed the false Messiah. Okay. But I mean, you know, your cousin doesn't believe in anything. You know what I mean? You know what I'm saying? He doesn't even believe in God. But that's all right. That's better. At least he's not a Christian. I mean, you know, and what I'm saying is that's got to be very difficult to maintain against believing Jews. So I think that that's probably, I would expect that as time goes on, especially in this time, because I don't believe we're in the end times, I feel, you know, I don't believe, but I feel like we're headed towards that. Well, of course we are headed towards it, but I feel like I want to see that in my lifetime. Maybe I will see that in my lifetime. I've always felt I would. But the reason I deny we're in the end times is because I also know it could be centuries away. But this could be a great time of renewal of God's people in the faith, which is their inheritance. And I would rejoice to see that. So now continuing into chapter 15, which is that is what this Bible study is. Verse 1, the burden or doom of Moab. Because in the night, Ar of Moab is laid waste and brought to silence. Because in the night, Ker of Moab is laid waste and brought to silence. He has gone up to Baith and to Dibon, the high places, to weep. Moab shall howl over Nebo and over Medeba. On all their heads shall be baldness, and every beard cut off. In their streets they shall gird themselves with sackcloth. On the tops of their houses and in their streets, everyone shall howl, weeping abundantly. I have a song for this chapter. You can download that for free on oraclesofgod.org. All my material is always free. And you can just, you know, visit oraclesofgod.org and download anything you like. I have a lot of, about a third of the book of Isaiah, a third or more actually, of the book has been made into songs. So this is one of them. I like them all because I wrote them, and I hope that other people might enjoy them too. Moab as a country is descended from Lot. And we talked about Sodom and Gomorrah. Lot was that nephew of Abraham who lived in Sodom and Gomorrah, whom the angels visited, who was warned of the destruction of the city, who defended the angels when the men of Sodom wished to sodomize them, which is where we get that from. Bring these men out that we may know them, which is an old euphemism for have sexual relations. What they encountered was a gang of men who wanted to rape some visitors. You know, the angels weren't peeking in windows and finding some sort of you know, private enterprise going on, which is still an abomination, but definitely not the reason which God brought fire down from the sky. This is a city that was wholly given over to wickedness. Anyways, obviously this had an effect on Lot's family. He escaped with his wife and daughters, but his wife looked back and was turned into a pillar of salt, looking back to the destruction of that wicked city. His daughters, though, escaped with him. And Lot did not wish to marry them to any of the men of the land because they were heathen and strangers, and he did not care to give his daughters to wife of any of them. So they seduced him. And two children were born, Ammon and Moab. Moab means of his mother's father. And the very name of Moab indicates, is an indication of the incest that went on, that is the founding of that nation. The nation was founded by an incestual relationship between father and two daughters, the two nations, Moab and Ammon, the two sons that were born of that. They wanted sons, and they obtained them from their father. Moab was a neighboring nation that when the Israelites began their conquest of the land, they were not to take the land of the Moabites. They were not to conquer the land of the Moabites because they were considered kin. Now, the Moabites were considered enemies because Balak, the king of the Moabites, was the one who hired Balaam to come and curse the Israelites as they were traveling out of the wilderness into the promised land. They were afraid of the Israelites, and so they hired Balaam. And when Balaam could not curse the Israelites, Balaam taught the Moabites how to cause the Israelites to curse themselves by enticing them into fornication, into worshiping other gods. And you can read about that in Numbers. So the relationship between the Moabites and the Israelites were hostile. And that animosity led to open warfare and, of course, to conspiracies against each other and alliances and so forth. They were subdued by David during his reign and became tributaries, eventually revolting during the time of Jehoshaphat, I believe, which would have been a few generations before the time of Isaiah. But they also came under the power of the king of Assyria. And that is the main problem, is that, you know, the Philistines were destroyed by the Assyrians. The Moabites were destroyed by the Assyrians. The Assyrians were an ancient empire that really swallowed up so many things. That's why these are the typology we've been talking about as far as the king of Babylon, the king of Assyria, are prophetic, you know, pictures of things you see in Revelation. And then you look at some of the later prophecies, they're very influenced by the old prophets. And they saw parallels in the prophetic teachings of the earlier prophets down through the later prophets and, of course, the New Testament, the works of the apostles and the prophecies they spoke about, and, of course, of Christ. There are many parallels. So we can take lessons from these different things. The Moabites are, you know, a heathen nation who were the enemies of God's people. And they are overcome when the enemy invades the land. The enemy that God has raised up and sent to destroy Israel also encompasses all the nations round about. And you see a similar picture of that in the book of Revelation, where, you know, the beast that has come to seduce the great whore, which is a picture of false Christianity, of course, the whole world goes after him. All the world wanders after the beast. You know, he rules over all the kindreds and nations and tongues and people. Doesn't mention religions because he will become their religion. But the king of Assyria is a similar type of force coming in and overwhelming everything and becoming the everything, carrying all into captivity. And that's why the captivities, the various captivities of Assyria and Babylon are so important. What is one of the things that it says in the book of Revelation in chapter 13? It says, if any man have an ear, let him hear. He that leadeth into captivity shall go into captivity. He that kills with the sword shall be killed with the sword. Here is the patience and faith of the saints. The lesson of the Old Testament captivities is, we're supposed to look at that. When we look at Revelation, when we look at chapter 13, when we look at the things we read about at the end that we may have to face, and that the world will certainly have to face eventually, and if not us, our descendants, whether spiritual descendants or carnal descendants, whether it's our children or our disciples that we shall make in the future, you know, because we have to pass on what we have learned to others, as generations before us have done. We want to leave the state of the church in a better state. You know, I hope that through my ministry to leave people more prepared for the end times, to prepare the way that people might be ready to face the challenges that we will undoubtedly have to face as a church. As people don't think the church is in the book of Revelation. You know, I spent some time in Iowa giving a performance musically. I met a dear friend, and one of the things I mentioned to him was about the fact that you do see the church in the book of Revelation. The two witnesses are the two candlesticks. The seven candlesticks are the seven churches. The five candlesticks that are missing are the ones that fell away. And if one spends some time looking into the churches, into the witnesses, you will see that the witnesses really are the churches, or what's left of them. So the church definitely has a role. Even if you don't believe you're going to go through the end times, you should still be doing the things that I counsel. Because the things I'm counseling are the things the scriptures counsel. Seek righteousness, seek holiness. We want to obtain the gifts of the Spirit of God. We want to live out the gifts we've been given to the fullest extent that we can. You know what I mean? Whatever we've been given, we want to fully use the power and gifts that God has given us to the greatest extent, to the greatest benefit of the church, however large or small that may be. But we definitely want to use what we've been given. We don't want to be like the man with one talent who buried it in the earth, and the master says, "You wicked servant." Or like the seed that fell on stony ground, which Jesus said was someone who hears the word of the kingdom and immediately receives it with joy. I receive the word. I receive the kingdom. But when tribulation or persecution ariseth, they fall away. The Moabites represent the ungodly. Their prophecy is pretty straightforward. You know, when the enemy comes in, the king of Assyria or the end times Antichrist, when he comes in, all that they hold near and dear is going to be laid waste. And the night is in a night. I mean, the thief comes in the night to kill and to destroy. And in a night, in a moment, in a very, you know, in a very short period of time, suddenly, overnight, their cities that they had rejoicing in, that they took confidence from, are brought down. Whether it be literal cities that may be brought down by some of the natural disasters that will accompany the beginning of the end times, or whether it be all the intellectual structures and powers that they put their trust in. You know, when a supernatural being appears from the sky, they may have all kinds of explanations for it, but they will be carried away by whatever that power brings. You know, I've read many books, whether it be scientific, science fiction, you know, thrillers, adventures. I'm a pretty widely read guy, okay? And one thing I find fascinating is science fiction, because it's sort of like the opposite of the Bible. I mean, not all science fiction. Some is written with a different perspective. But a lot of it is written from a very ungodly perspective, and I appreciate sort of understanding how other people think. That's how I work. You know, they say if an alien race appeared with advanced enough technology, they would be sort of indistinguishable from gods. I remember as a youth, my dad always suggested that perhaps the Antichrist could come like E.T., you know. Well, I think in that form, it would be unlikely that the cute, fat little alien would be worshipped as a god. But, you know, if an alien came with sufficient technology, they could perhaps convince us that they are gods. Or, if supernatural beings appeared, we might be able to justify it and say, well, they're just aliens with superior technology. However you look at it, it is sort of irrelevant because you are going to be carried away with that power. Whatever that power is dictating or forcing upon you. I mean, it's like when a superior culture invades an inferior culture, they are absolutely carried away by that power. You look at Native American culture being invaded by European culture. And European culture wasn't really that much more advanced. I mean, they were more advanced. It was certainly not that overwhelming. The advantage was quite distinct, but not, you know, that incredible. You know, where you would have something that wasn't a god could be perceived as a god. And that's what we know from the writing of Paul in Thessalonians. And it's also suggested in that manner in Revelation 13 that the Antichrist is going to appear to be a god and perhaps be supernatural in origin or seem to be so. Either supernatural in origin or extraterrestrial in origin. That doesn't mean he won't be anthropomorphic. I certainly think the Antichrist is going to appear to be a man. Because in prophecies, in his degradation, he is referred to as being nothing more than a man. The unbelieving peoples that the Moabites represent, you know, the enemies of God people, are going to be swept away. The unbelievers are going to be completely overwhelmed by the power of the enemy, just the way the Moabites were overwhelmed by the Assyrians. He has gone up to Baith and to Dibon, the high places to weep. I say Baith and not Bejith because I know that the J is usually being translated from a Y in Hebrew, and the I's are usually long. So, you know, he's going, obviously these are places he's going to weep, and probably of religious significance. You know, they're going to mourn over their gods that failed them, or their science that failed them, or their society that, you know, whatever they had put their trust in that is now lost in the face of the calamity, of the cataclysm that the Antichrist represents, or that the Assyrian represented to the Moabites. They will be weeping and mourning over what they've lost. You know, their culture is overthrown. The things they trusted in were not protection. They shall howl over Nebo and over Medeba. You know, these are the lost cities that have been taken captive. On all their heads should be baldness and every beard cut off. That was the sign of mourning in the ancient world, in the Near East. In the ancient Near East, they would shave their heads, pluck out their beards, and that was a sign of mourning. In their streets they shall gird themselves with sackcloth. On the tops of their houses and in their streets, everyone shall howl, weeping abundantly. You know, men would cut off their beards, cut their hair, dress themselves in sacking for clothing, you know, in very poor garments, not in festive things, to sort of show, to try to demonstrate, or provoke the gods to look upon their sorrow and see what has befallen them, to try to attract attention. You know, fasting functions very similarly. Verse 4, and Heshbon shall cry, and Elealeh, their voice shall be heard even to Jahaz. Therefore, the armed soldiers of Moab shall cry out, his life shall be grievous to him, or his soul shall be broken up within him. Where things are so bad that the life becomes grievous, like just having to live. You know, it's a thing we understand where, you know, you just want to escape. You want to just not even deal with the horror that you're facing. That's the kind of idiom we're talking about. His life shall be grievous to him, or his soul shall be grievous to him. It's an idiom. We still use similar types of things today, you know, where, oh, I hated life because of what has befallen me. It doesn't really mean that you hate life or your soul is actually grieving you, but in a sense that, you know, having life and having a soul and being able to perceive all the evil that has befallen you, it makes you just want to throw your hands up and give up. And that's the way they're going to experience this calamity. You know, the armed soldiers who were supposed to defend the nation against this attack. You know, and I think, you know, I always take it in a spiritual direction or a cultural direction. You know, the philosophers, the scientists, the religious leaders, all the men who were predicting one course of events who have found that another course of events is what there is being forced upon them. They are going to be grieved intensely over these developments. Verse 5, my heart shall cry out for Moab. His fugitives shall flee unto Zoar, and Hefer of 3 years old. For by the mounting up of Luhith, with weeping shall they go it up. For in the way of Horonaim, they shall raise up a cry of destruction. My heart shall cry out for Moab. I'm going to see this. You know, that every human being, even as an enemy, you can empathize with their utter loss and being at a loss and suffering a calamity unprepared. You know, I've had people at times point out to me bad things that happen to people. You know, if it happens to their enemies, we tend to think sometimes, you know, God's punishing them. And maybe he is. I'm not denying that. But, you know, what about when bad things happen to us? Well, God's punishing us, is he? It's not always so. Look at Job. Now, Job was a righteous man, and all those things befell him, and it wasn't a punishment from God. You know, naked we go into the world, and naked we're going out. Everything we get in between is bonus. All the goodness God gives us is not something he owes us. People always marvel at, you know, handicapped people who still can smile and, you know, they have a short life, but they still love every minute of it. And it's very painful, and people say, how could God do such a thing? You know, what if God had created a world in which everyone lives for 5 minutes? Would that be wicked of him? What if he did it just so that, you know, more people could have a chance? I mean, why is it bad of God to give good things to people? Well, it's not good. He has no legs or arms. Ask him if he likes being alive. Maybe some people, oh, I wish you, you know, through jealousy or through envy, we might feel that way. But what if nobody had any arms or legs? I've used this argument many times. But what if nobody had those things? You know, we'd all just be glad to exist. If we all lived for 5 minutes, no one would question 5 minutes. And we'd weep over the man who lives for 3. And we'd marvel at the guy who gets 6. Because everything is sort of relative. But from God's perspective, he's given creatures that are non-existent an existence. He who lives forever is giving those who are nothing something. But as a human being, we should be able to empathize with each other's losses, no matter who they are. I don't care if they're Muslims or whoever. I know, yeah, you know, they're cutting people's head off. They're evil. They're crooked. They're doing all these things. But they're delusional, deceived people who on some level deserve pity. Even the Lord Jesus from the cross, as he was being crucified, they crucified him. He said, forgive them, for they know not what they do. That was his attitude. I think those that pierced him are going to look on him in fear and tremble. And I don't think necessarily they're going to be forgiven, but some of them who pierced him are forgiven. He was wounded for our transgressions. So though I wasn't there to put the nail in his hands, he laid down his life so that I might live. So on some level, I have some responsibility for that. I certainly feel a responsibility. You know, that's what inspires me to want to live a better life, because he laid down his life so that I might live. why wouldn't I want to make the most of that? So we ought to have empathy for even our enemies in their hour of destruction. You know, the Lord is executing great judgment and just judgment. He doesn't rejoice in this. It is what must be. You know, God doesn't take some sort of perverted pleasure in the destruction of the wicked. He does it because it is what is right. It is what they have coming. It's what is fair. He does not take some sort of perverted pleasure in it. Neither should we. Our house should cry out in recognition. It's not that God, oh, God is unfair. He's destroying them. No, he is being fair. But let your heart cry out. Because but for the grace of God, that could be you. Oh, an heifer of 3 years old. I don't want to blow over the verses. I mean, I'm just taking the meaning out of them. His fugitives shall flee to Zoar, an heifer of 3 years old. That's metaphor. Like an heifer of 3 years old. That would be a simile, but that's what he means. It's like, as a heifer of 3 years old, they shall flee a heifer of 3 years old. What it means is they're fleeing like a three-year-old cow. I'm not sure exactly what that meant to Isaiah. I don't know if a cow would have calved after 3 years. I'm assuming three-year-old heifer. I mean, I understand why in the first year they would not have a calf probably because they'd still be coming to maturity. But by 3 years, I would assume that's plenty old to have calved at least once. And so maybe there's something about a cow that has had a calf that causes it to flee like that. Maybe there's something especially pathetic about a three-year-old heifer. I don't know. Since he's saying, I will raise up a cry, or he was saying, my heart will cry out. He's saying that, so I'm thinking, well, perhaps that's an indication of the pitifulness. Maybe that's why he uses a heifer. Maybe a heifer is a sort of a sympathetic thing. It would certainly make sense in context. You know, he is sympathizing with the Moabites because they're no different than cattle. You know, that might be his perspective. They're like dumb animals. They've gone astray. And they're fleeing from the destruction. You know, when anyone sees an animal, I mean, any normal person sees an animal in danger, you know, you do not feel pity for the dumb beast. Your enemies are no different. They're dumb beasts that have gone astray. Pity them. You know, that is the ultimate perspective as God's people we have, because we are going to live forever. They're going to perish like some beast, like some heifer, raised for meat. They have a purpose, but they will not persist forever. Their end and their calamity, we ought to have sympathy with. Because the Lord, the judge of all, also has sympathy, even though he does what his justice requires. Verse 6, for the waters of Nimrim shall be desolate, for the hay is withered away, the grass faileth, there is no green thing. Therefore the abundance they have gotten, and that which they have laid up, shall they carry away to the brook of the willows. I'm not sure if this means like through some sort of drought, the hay is going to wither away, the grass faileth, there is no green thing. I definitely see shades of the first trumpet, all green grass burn up. A third of the trees smitten. And that definitely makes me think of that immediately. But their suffering may have to do with the invasion. Whenever an army invades, you know, there's always disruption of normal agriculture. And if that's compounded with some sort of drought at the same time, that can all cause everything to fade away, or to wither away, I mean. And, you know, there may not be opportunities to irrigate or to look after those crops. You know, I'm not sure. I'm speculating a bit there. But the green things, you know, it could be also purely, it could be purely symbolic of the withering of their nation. You know, that there's no good seen anymore. All the green is faded away. You know, the waters of Nimrim shall be desolate. You know, Nimrim would have been a waterway. You know, there's no waters there. That which they depended on for their livelihood, the waters which had supplied them, are now cut off. And the abundance they have gotten, obviously there had been good times. They have things laid up. They're going to carry away to the brook of the willows. Carry away what? Because they're fleeing from the calamity that is threatening to overwhelm their whole nation. And they will carry away what they can and try to save what they can. Carry it away to some place where they can still find some good, to the brook of the willows. For the cry has gone round about the borders of Moab, the howling thereof unto Eglaim, the howling thereof unto Beer Elim. For the waters of Dimon shall be full of blood. For I will bring more upon Dimon, lions upon him that escapeth of Moab, and upon the remnant of the land. Yeah, they're going to be fleeing, they're going to be crossing waters, but the waters are going to be full of blood. There will be slain men, but the waters will be full of blood. There will be men slain, and their blood will foul the waters. He will bring upon the waters of Dimon, when they come fleeing to the brook of the willows. Maybe that refers to this Dimon. They will flee with all their carriage, all their baggage, and be slain. And more will come upon them. Lions. You know, wild animals attacking them in their weakness, in their state of devastation, that lions would come and tear at them. Now that may refer literally to literal animal lions, or it might refer to bandits and such. That just kind of comes to me that, you know, that might be symbolic. That's a possibility that, you know, the bandits or other sort of calamities coming upon them, lions in the wilderness, could be a euphemism for being slain by bandits in the wilderness. That's a possibility. You know, take that or leave it. You know, I say these things based on my long experience with the scripture and throw it out as there as a possibility. And also, I would not want to forget to point out the prophetic reference. Lions, you know, their teeth were as the teeth of lions. They had breastplates, as it were, breastplates of iron. Revelation chapter 9. What am I saying? Is this a prophecy of the end times like that? No, but the things written in Revelation, all those symbolic images point back to things in the prophets that were written before. And yes, lessons can be drawn from them. The overall interpretation, I think, is pretty straightforward, pretty clear. The burden of Moab. Moab's doom.